United Nations office in the capital Sana'a. They denounced the international community for turning a blind eye on the continued seizure of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition, which has put the war-torn country to a severe fuel crisis.
I suffer from kidney failure and I have to travel 50 kilometers to get to the dialysis center despite the lack of fuel. I need dialysis 3 times a week, but I only get 1 because of the blockade on our country. We call on the international organizations to stand by our side and help us to get the fuel in order to save our lives.
The Ministry of Health said over 1,500 medical facilities, including dialysis centers, are on the verge of total shutdown due to the lack of fuel. The ministry has urged the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the seized oil tankers.
Blocking oil vessels from entering the country threatens to stop many health facilities. There are more than 1,500 health centers and 400 laboratories and blood banks on the verge of closure. Centers that generate oxygen may also stop. The lives of patients may end within days. Patients with kidney problems are the most affected. There are more than 5,000 patients who need dialysis several times a week.
The United Nations says the Saudi war on Yemen, along with the years-long blockade, has driven the country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Thousands of patients, including children, may lose their lives within days unless the international community breaks its silence and pressures Saudi Arabia to release the illegally detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
About turning innovative ideas into practice. Towards Stars is the title of this exhibition, which puts on display the latest technologies that are made in Iran. A whole range of high-tech products, from mapping drones to smart medical equipment, are showcased here. Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, hailed the Iranian tech companies for helping to keep the national industries afloat amid foreign pressures.
In spite of the unilateral sanctions on our country, we have been able to serve our needs by tapping into our domestic resources and young minds. Technological development builds power and makes us independent from foreign powers. When a nation is independent, no other country can exert pressure on it.
The event was inspired by remarks made by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in August last year, where he put emphasis on the need to focus on science-based production and avoid exporting raw material and bulk goods, such as saffron. Given the fact that Iran produces 90% of the world's saffron, this Iranian producer has launched the so-called OSEC. It might sound music to the ears, since it rhymes with OPEC. Only the letter S stands for saffron. The Organization of Saffron Exporting Countries now is an established entity, comprising 10 member states, with the goal to organize the global market.
The idea to set up the OSEC was driven by the fact that Iran, which has OSEC, is the hub of saffron production. But when it comes to exports, we are lagging behind. So OSEC seeks to organize the global market, not only for saffron, but with regards to caraway and caviar.
Well, there's a growing focus in Iran on commercializing indigenous products. This medical firm says the issue of marketing is still an alien word when it comes to Iranian-made products. But it says that's what it does.
Our company offers medical services in Iraq, Indonesia, and Afghanistan using Iranian-made equipment like hemodialysis systems and central water purification systems. In fact, we do the marketing job for Iranian manufacturers of medical equipment and offer the related services for our clients. We are working to find clients in more countries.
Iran has recently been trying to make a shift from an oil-based economy to other sources of income. The major drive behind such a move is to shield the economy from the ups and downs of oil prices. In recent years, such a shift is more vital, since Iran's crude sales have slashed as a result of U.S.'s unilateral sanctions against Iran. This event comes as Iran is already rewiring its economy based on domestic production. This is significant given the fact that U.S. sanctions against Iran have denied the country access to foreign trade. but Tehran regards the restrictions as a blessing in disguise, saying self-sufficiency is the fruit of sanctions. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners held in the Israeli military jail of Aofir declared a set of measures, including a partial hunger strike, to protest excessive repression and assaults of the Israeli prison service that have been escalating dramatically. According to Palestinian Prisoners Club Association, prisoners in Aofir jail have been subjected to harassment and repression, intensive provocative cell searches, and repeated raids on prisoners' rooms, especially at night. Prisoners have also been suffering from transfers from one prison to another, in addition to deliberate medical negligence.
Israeli measures are illegal and they are carried out against the prisoners in Aofir every day. That's why we say what goes on in Israeli jails amounts to a crime against the prisoners. Today the prisoners are suffering from medical negligence. We hold Israeli regime responsible for the consequences of these actions.
Talks have been held between prisoners and the Israel prison service. However, they have failed to meet the inmates' key demands. Thus, the prisoners will even escalate their protest measures within the coming days. Palestinian prisoners have been trying to resist the crackdown through all possible means, including boycotting military courts and going on hunger strikes.
Hunger strikes are almost the only means which the inmates have at hand to put pressure on Israeli authorities. Israel knows very well that the prisoners are able to achieve victory through their hunger strike and protest action as they did in the past.
Human rights organizations say Israel continues to violate all rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention and international laws. Today, over 4,500 Palestinians are languishing in a number of Israeli jails, according to Palestinian reports. Palestinian inmates have been subjected to systematic torture all through the years of Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. Those prisoners are behind bars in the first place for defying the Israeli occupation in all its forms. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
It's been almost 6 months since the first intra-Afghan talks in the Qatari capital Doha, but so far no viable agreement has been reached. The situation in Afghanistan has now become so complicated that the Afghan president is agreeing to hold an early election.
We stand ready to discuss holding free, fair, and inclusive elections under the auspices of the international community. We can also talk about the date of the elections and reach a conclusion.
Ashraf Ghani, however, strongly rejected a U.S. plan to form an interim government. The Afghan president said the only legitimate way to gain political power in Afghanistan is through elections.
Any institution can write a fiction on a piece of paper and suggest a solution for Afghanistan. These papers have been written in the past and will be written in the future. Our guarantee is our constitution.
President Ghani's comments came after calls for forming an interim government in Afghanistan increased in the past couple of months. This is why the U.S. Special Representative Zalmay Khalilzad met some top prominent political leaders, tribal elders, and other influential figures during his recent visit to Kabul. The meeting soon faced mixed reactions. Many here say the main agenda of Khalilzad is to convince the Afghan president to accept an interim government and hold another round of talks in Turkish capital Ankara. While the Afghan government brands the establishment of any interim government as the death of democracy in Afghanistan, President Ghani's yes to an early election is considered as a green light for the Taliban to join a democratic process in order to gain power. Now, only time will tell whether or not the Taliban, the Afghan government, and the U.S. can make a comprehensive agreement or not. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Yemenis talk together in front of the UN office in Sana'a to slam the UN donor conference and renew their calls on the international organization and the international community to end the Saudi piracy against Yemeni oil ships.
We hope that they will talk about the ships of oil derivatives at the donors' conference. The Yemeni people need fuel just as they need food and medicine. There are thousands of trucks carrying aid that are parked in and could not reach the Yemenis because of the lack of fuel. We want serious action from the United Nations to release oil ships.
Protesters described the UN donor conference as a historical farce. Yemeni said the detained oil vessels must be released and the Saudi war as well as the blockade of Yemen must be stopped.
The donors conference is nothing more than a historical farce. We do not need humanitarian aid, but rather to lift the blockade and release oil ships.
The Yemenis do not need a donor conference as much as they need to bring in oil ships, and we do not want the United Nations to begin in the name of our dear people.
14 Yemeni oil ships remain at the Saudi-led coalition's detention illegally. The vessels were inspected and authorized by the United Nations through verification and inspection mechanism. The detention has led the country to a harsh shortage of fuel.
Yemenis say instead of raising funds for its organization's expenses, the UN must pressure Saudi Arabia to release the detained oil vessels if it wants to help the humanitarian situation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Italy, disgruntled by the delay of vaccine supplies to Rome and general vaccine shortages in the EU, has called for a shipment to Australia to be blocked. By doing so, it is activating for the first time an export control system instituted by the bloc to make sure companies like the Anglo-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca honour their contracts. Australia says its vaccine rollout will not be affected by the ban.
They are in an unbridled crisis situation. That is not the situation in Australia, but nevertheless, we've been able to secure our supplies and additional supplies for importation both with Pfizer and AstraZeneca, which means we can continue the rollout of our program.
Out of 450 million Europeans, only 11 million have had a COVID-19 jab. Tired of waiting, countries like Denmark, Austria, Poland, Slovakia and the Czech Republic have given up on Brussels and turned to other suppliers. This week, Hungary received its first shipment of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine as another surge of the virus races across the country.
By next week, Hungary will be the most vaccinated country within the European Union. But even this pace is not fast enough to prevent the spread of the virus and especially its new variants.
The EU is only using Western-approved vaccines at the moment. Europe's drug regulator has launched a review of Russia's Sputnik V, which has an efficacy of 91.6%, insisting geopolitics is not affecting decision-making.
I would like to say very clearly, EMA undertakes its analysis of a vaccine based on health-related criteria related to the safety and the efficacy of the vaccine. Full stop. There is no other consideration than that. And therefore, geopolitics have nothing to do with the fact that you consider that EMA would consider a vaccine safe and efficacious or not. It's based on the assessment of the vaccine.
Russia says it is ready to provide jabs for 50 million Europeans the moment it gets the green light. Vaccine rollouts will only work if they happen fast and evenly across continents, outsmarting mutations. Amid a surge of cases across the whole of Europe, the EU has launched a continent-wide project to strip out supply bottlenecks and boost production, hoping to redeem itself and stave off a third wave. Bianca Rahimi, London.
is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian sky.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor, give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Debate.
Hi, everybody, and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Now, it's been a sad day for European democracy. That's how Carlos Puigdemont has described the European Parliament vote to lift his immunity and that of two other MEPs. The trio have been members of the European Parliament. They fled to Belgium in October 2017 following a Catalan independence referendum. They're wanted by Madrid for what it calls holding an illegal vote. Madrid has held the EU Parliament's decision, saying that it shows the Catalan issue must be resolved in Spain. So what's next? What's going to become of Catalonia's independence drive? Stay with us for a debate. Let's first go to our correspondent in Barcelona, Cusay Catri, and let's see what he has for us. Cusay, give us some more information. What's the process like? What's going to happen?
Well, Behrouz, this vote today in Parliament has been welcomed by Spain as a victory of the rule of law over the adventurism of Catalan separatists who fled to Belgium after organizing the 2017 referendum. On the other hand, in Catalonia, the separatists consider that even though it is a victory, it is a Pyrrhic victory because it means that Spain will be dragged into the legal limbo that it has created itself, and that's what they say, that's what they argue. And this is liable to drag on in European courts. They seem to have no worries that Puigdemont and his aides will be extradited to Spain anytime soon. And they take for evidence the example of another Catalan fugitive who Belgian courts decided not to extradite to Spain under the request of Spain's Supreme Court, arguing that this court is not really habilitated to try him, and it also expressed reservation on the fundamental rights of this particular person called Lluís Puig. He was a former Catalan official. Whether his fundamental rights will be guaranteed if he were to be extradited in Spain. So it is probably a victory for Spain, which has been tracking the evolution of these fugitives in Europe, but at the same time, the pro-independence movement seems confident, at least their defense team seem confident, that they will be heard in the European Court of Justice when they will appeal this decision to strip them of their immunity.
Okay, thank you for that. Cusay Catri, correspondent in Barcelona. Now, let me invite one of our guests who will be joining me in tonight's debate show. We'll have Associate Professor at the University of Southern Denmark, Jaume Castan Pinos from Copenhagen. Hopefully I pronounce your name. Is it Jaume or Jean?
Jaume.
Jaume. Okay. Now, Jaume, my first question for you is that Puigdemont has called this European Parliament decision a case of political prosecution. Does he have a point? Do you agree?
Let's remember, first of all, that Puigdemont party, Junts per Europa, in the 2019 European Parliament elections was the most voted party in Catalonia. So this is important to clarify. First, they have three representatives. They were the biggest parliament, the biggest party in the in those elections. And so with today's lifting of immunity, among other things, the what we are seeing is that the most voted party in Catalonia, the three representatives, have their immunity. Their immunity has been lifted. So this is I agree with Mr. Puigdemont in the sense that today's the political rights of three representatives today have been violated, but not only of those three representatives, but also of the over 1 million people who voted for them. So I think, in a way, it is indeed a sad day for democracy. Your correspondent was saying earlier on that this was somehow a Pyrrhic victory. And I think this is somehow the way it should be read, because it is a victory, without a doubt, a political victory for Spain, an expected victory, one should say, because the, let's say, that Spanish diplomacy was very active trying to convince members of the European Parliament in order to vote, in order to remove this immunity. But as your correspondent very well argued, this battle, legal battle and political battle, is very far from being over.
Okay. Now, we have another guest. Our second guest is also joining us. We have academic and political analyst Sergio Castano joining us out of Valladolid. And now, Sergio, what is likely to happen to the three pro-independence Catalan figures?
Hello. It's uncertain the future of these three politicians. 3 years ago, everyone considered that probably the end of these three politicians was in jail. But after 3 years, they are not only free, but they are participating in European politics. So what could happen in the future? Who knows? But apparently, after these 3 years, Europeans start to understand that this political issue in Spain, that many consider a national political issue that should be solved here in Spain, became international. Catalan political leaders, or independentist Catalan political leaders, wanted to internationalize this process in order to get support from the European Union, from other countries. But the European Parliament confirms today that in this case, they want to respect the national rules and they want to stop with nationalism, because nationalism in Catalonia or in the County Basque here in Spain are not the only nationalism in Europe. There are other territories. And a sentence favorable for these three politicians in this case could affect other territories. So what could happen? We don't know, but probably they are going to suffer the more restrictions and more difficulties in the future, and probably they will have to face to the Spanish court.
Okay. Jaume, Madrid is expected to move to reactivate a European arrest warrant to bring them back to Spain for trial. But the extradition will have to be decided first by Belgium justice system. So what do you expect to happen in that court? Could it judge again that the Spanish Supreme Court is not competent to try the trio like it did in a similar case before?
Mm-hmm. If I may say, I somehow disagree with the, or perhaps somehow disagree with the, with my fellow, with my fellow colleague. I think that when we talk about nationalism, it is important to claim that the most important nationalism in, or one of the most important nationalisms when it comes to the Catalan conflict, is Spanish nationalism as well. It is a form of nationalism, even though it is the hegemonic one. Now, that being said, over the past 3 years, Spain has been humiliated several times, and I use the word very carefully, and the word is humiliated. Spain has been humiliated several times by European courts, by, in particular, by the Belgian court last year, which decided, as your correspondent said, that Lluís Puig, a former Catalan minister, could not be extradited on the grounds that his political rights could be violated if extradited. So I think this is, and Spain was counting that this extradition would be automatic. But it wasn't. It wasn't in the case of Puigdemont in Neumünster in Germany. It wasn't in the case of Lluís Puig in Belgium. And it wasn't in the case of former Catalan minister Consellera Ponsatí in Scotland. So these, all these, let's say, legal defeats that Spain has experienced in the past have, I think, have account for, or they are nothing short of humiliation for Spain. And nothing guarantees that further humiliations will occur in the future. Because I think if we take this precedent of Minister Luis Puig, I think something quite similar might happen in the future. So even though in Spain they might be celebrating this so-called victory today, maybe in the future they will not be as happy as it has been today. By the way, one more comment. I would like to say that the Spanish government has really tried not to internationalize the Catalan conflict, claiming that it was an internal affair. Well, today we have seen, something is that this conflict is not a Spanish internal affair. The conflict is very much alive and present in European institutions, including the European Parliament.
Yeah, and also we are discussing it in our debate show. Okay, go ahead with your comments. What's going to happen in this Belgian court?
According to what's happened 3 years ago, probably the Belgian court reacts in the same way, and they will not allow the transfer of these three politicians to Spain. Probably the resolution will be in the European court, and in this case the Belgian court doesn't want to have this responsibility because there are another institution, and probably after the decision of the European Parliament the European institutions will resolve this conflict. But in this regard, Belgium was clear 3 years ago, and Belgium, I don't understand why, because the legal European system advanced toward integration. In general, the European Union wants to integrate the institutions, countries advance toward a real integration, but in this case, in this legal specific issue, Belgium reacted contrary to this general approach favoring legal integration in Europe, and in this case I think they are going to maintain the same position and will be the European court who will resolve this problem.
All right. Now, Jaume, the European Parliament's decision comes only weeks after regional elections in Catalonia that increased the majority of pro-independence parties in the regional parliament. Now, does the vote mean more divergence and confrontation between the Catalans and the Spanish government?
Two comments. First of all, my colleague did not understand why Belgian courts refused to extradite. I do understand why, and in fact, I may share it with the audience. I do understand why. If one reads the reports from the United Nations Group on Arbitrary Detention, which, by the way, the Belgian court used in 2020, they used those conclusions, they say quite clearly that the detentions from the Catalan leaders who are actually in prison, in jail now for nine leaders who have been in prison for 3.5 years. So they do say very clearly that they constitute arbitrary detentions. So it is not a surprise, not at all, why those leaders have not been extradited, because institutions such as the UN Group on Arbitrary Detentions have very, very clearly stated that those detentions are amount to arbitrary account, they are arbitrary detentions. So therefore, for me, it is therefore quite clear why they haven't been extradited. And yes, this extradition has not been as automatic as Spain wanted to, because instead of power politics, that is, instead of national interests, the Belgian courts have actually addressed the issue, and they have found plenty of inconsistencies in the Spanish extradition arrest warrant. Now, that being said, yes, certainly, we have had elections in Catalonia recently. The pro-independence parties have approximately a 52% majority in Parliament. Mm-hmm. And we have seen as well how a singer, a rapper, was arrested, and that created a Catalan rapper was arrested for singing against the monarchy, the corrupt monarchy in Spain, the corrupt king. And so we have seen that, and of course, I can guarantee that this issue is once again polarizing even more the Catalan society, and of course, keeping the conflict alive, if you wish. And of course, if in the unlikely event that Puigdemont and his colleagues were extradited to Spain, certainly that would create uproar and certainly plenty of, let's say, instability in Catalonia.
Sergio, Madrid claims that a European Parliament vote indicates that matters related to Catalonia should be determined in Spain, not in Europe. What's in Madrid's agenda as regards independence for Catalonia?
Madrid's agenda is clear. Madrid wants to judge this situation, this rebellion from 2017 is now difficult because they escaped from justice. But the agenda is clear. Madrid wants to bring the three politicians here to Spain and continues the process in Madrid. But the Catalan problem goes beyond these three politicians or other politicians in Switzerland or in other European countries, because this is a social and political problem, and the arrest of these three politicians and even the prosecution of these politicians in Spain will not solve this political conflict. So more things must be done in this regard in order to try to find a solution or make a balance between these 52% of the Catalan society supporting independentism, this another 48% supporting the integration or the Ottoman time in Spain. And this is the reason why the two political parties in power in the government, Podemos and Socialist Party, discuss about this present situation. For example, Podemos condemned the Parliament, the European Parliament decision, while the Socialist Party support and consider that it was a right decision from the Parliament, the European Parliament. So there are divisions within the government, divisions within the Catalan society and within the Spanish society.
Jaume, as you know, a number of former Catalan officials have been convicted of sedition and sentenced to 13 years behind bars. We also have this latest move, stripping Puigdemont and two others of their immunity. How do you foresee the prospect of independence for Catalonia?
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed, the leadership of the pro-independence movement is either in exile or behind bars or in jail, and that, of course, has been had a great impact for the Catalan pro-independence movement. We have seen how Catalan's pro-independence party somehow they have changed their discourses. They have somehow adopted more moderate strategies since the autumn of 2017. But however, this may very well change if depending on the dynamics. So this is a very volatile situation. So even though they have taken a step back, if you wish, or more moderate approaches, but this is very, very likely to change if, for example, we see a continuation in Spanish repression. I also wanted to comment on your earlier comment, on your previous comment about the Spanish foreign minister saying that this is a Spanish internal affair. This is quite interesting because this Spanish internal affair, we've also heard that from the European Commission. So it's very interesting when political rights are violated in a member state, such as Spain, then it becomes an internal affair. However, when situations occur abroad, when similar or perhaps not so similar situations occur abroad, the EU is very, very eager to comment and to interfere in the internal affairs of nations which are not in the European Union. And that is something which I think it's nothing short of double standards and political hypocrisy. Because when it comes to European states, the EU turns a blind eye. When it comes to a state outside of the European Union, they are very, very eager to interfere in the internal affairs of neighboring countries or of countries in other parts of the world.
Sergio, what would be the impact of the European Parliament's vote on the Spanish coalition government? Unidas Podemos MEPs voted to retain the immunity, while socialists voted for it to be removed.
Socialist Party and Podemos are in permanent tension, in permanent conflict, but they have to find a way to work together because this is the only way to maintain the Spanish government. But obviously the position of Podemos was clear since the beginning, since 2017. They supported the referendum a legal referendum, and Podemos is still supporting a legal referendum in Catalonia, but according to the Spanish constitution, it is not possible to make this legal referendum. For that reason, Catalan independentists organized this illegal referendum, and it was the origin of this conflict. But at the beginning, for example, in 2017, the Socialist Party rejected this illegal referendum, even the legal referendum, and when Socialist Party was the opposition, the main opposition party, Pedro Sánchez supported Mariano Rajoy in order to act against the referendum. So the position of the two parties is clear, and now they have reacted according to their preference, the Socialist Party supporting the parliament, the European Parliament decision, and Podemos supporting the independentist Catalan movement. And this tension will continue in the future, and after finishing the process, that I don't know if this process is going to finish in the next years. It's going to be difficult, but internal conflicts in the Spanish government are going to be permanent.
Now, Jaume, the Spanish government says that Catalonia's problem should be resolved in Spain, not in Europe. There are people who argue that the political conflict over Catalonia independence is not an internal affair, but it's a European issue. What's your position on this?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. As I said earlier, the EU tries to turn a blind eye, try to ignore this conflict, but you cannot do that. This conflict is a European conflict, unlike other conflicts where the EU is very eager to interfere. This is a conflict where the EU should actually be more actively engaged, but instead it shows once again that the EU is a bit of a club of states. Rather than something else. And so it really shows how the EU is really trying to help one of its own member states. So when there is a conflict of that nature, they really choose to ignore it. And also when it comes to the EU position regarding secessions or secessionist movements, I think it very much depends. If it is in their national interests, like for example, we have seen recently in Scotland, or we see also when it comes to Kosovo, they support those secessionists, and when it's against their interest, like in the case of Catalonia, they oppose that, and they really try to close their eyes, pretending that there is no conflict, but there is a conflict, and the conflict is not just a Spanish conflict, but it is certainly a European conflict, and we have seen the amount of interviews that former Catalan President Carles Puigdemont was getting with many, many European media, and we have seen that actually it is 42% of members of the European Parliament who have not who have voted against, let's say, the Spanish option, Spanish national interest. And I think that's quite remarkable, and it shows that maybe, even though the Catalans have lost today, but it shows that maybe there is the Spanish position is not as popular as one may presume.
Mm-hmm. Okay. On that note, we'll come to the end of this debate on Press TV. My guests have been academician and political analyst Sofia Castano out of Valladolid, and also associate professor with the University of Southern Denmark, Jaume Castan Pinos, joined us from Copenhagen with his contribution. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafin. I'll see you next time.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the VIRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
One of the top national security think tanks backing the Biden administration, the Center for a New American Security, has been taking money from every major defense contractor while pumping out a steady stream of research supporting those companies' interests. It's yet another sign that Biden's promised return to normal has unfortunately arrived, says Branko Mercetic, a writer, in an article published under the heading, Biden era is witnessing a return of the military-industrial complex. Stay tuned for more. The promise of a return to normal under Joe Biden always meant two possibilities. It could mean a hard break from the obscene, in-your-face corruption and self-dealing that defined Donald Trump's presidency. Or it could mean going back to the kind of run-of-the-mill, revolving-door Washington corruption that Trump had pledged to clean up, but ended up wallowing in. According to a new report by the Revolving Door Project titled The Military-Industrial Think Tank Complex, Conflict of Interest at the Center for the New American Security, it looks to be the latter option that is so far prevailing in the Biden years. Released recently, the report charges top Democratic foreign policy think tank, the Center for a New American Security, CNAS, of, at best, a serious deficiency of accountability, and at worst, a systematically corrupt arrangement that sees its promise to promote its corporate sponsors' interests while passing it off as a public good. The report recounts several examples of this arrangement. In 2009, for instance, CNAS published a report maintaining that the controversial use of private military contractors was essential and here to stay in wars like Afghanistan, all which, while taking money from several different firms providing those very services. One of these firms, DynCorp, was on the receiving end of $2.8 billion of the State Department's Afghanistan operations funding from 2002 to 2013, or 69% of the total sum. In another case, a 2018 CNAS report charged that the Air Force's plans to buy 100 B-21 bombers did not go far enough, pushing the military to add 50 to 75 more jets at an extra cost of $32.8 billion to $49.2 billion. Those profits would have gone to the bomber's maker, Northrop Grumman, an arms manufacturer that also happened to direct more than half of its total think tank donations during 2014 to 2019 period to CNAS. A year before that, CNAS had charged the UAE embassy in the United States $250,000 for a report advocating looser rules for exporting U.S. drones before publishing a separate paper calling on Trump to loosen those restrictions. The UAE ended up signing a nearly $200 million deal for the drones with General Atomics, whose billionaire chairman and CEO Neil Blue is both a generous donor to CNAS and sits on its board of advisors. In these and other examples, the report states the center failed to disclose the conflicts of interest in their reports, despite noting the existence of a policy on such conflicts in their tax filings. It also repeatedly violated the very clear line CNAS co-founder Kurt Campbell, then about to serve in Barack Obama's State Department and now serving on Biden's National Security Council, testified about in his 2009 confirmation hearing that CNAS doesn't write about specific products its drones make, but rather stays limited to big picture foreign policy ideas. The center's reliance on the corporate sector, particularly military contractors, is extensive, having taken donations from all big five such firms in the last decade, along with 24 others. According to a Center for International Policy report released last year, CNAS got more defense contractor money than any of the top 50 U.S. think tanks it analyzed. That's in addition to contributions from NATO, the governments of the United States, and even 11 other allied countries and corporate titans spanning fossil fuel, financial, tech, and other sectors, all of whom have given generously to CNAS over the years. As the report points out, CNAS own co-founder Michelle Flarney tipped to be Biden's defense secretary before her own extensive conflicts of interest derailed her, pointed out the issues with a corporate funding model in a 2014 speech. Every funder has intent. They're giving you money for a reason, she said. There are some organizations that call themselves think tanks that actually accept money from corporations to do very specific work that tends to advocate the programs those companies produce, and I think that sort of makes the waters more murky. The scale and scope of conflicts of interest that appear in CNAS work and the influence that its donors may be exerting on policy further highlights serious concerns about political corruption, wrote Brett Haynes, co-author of the report. Of course, CNAS is far from unique. A whole host of think tanks, including those in the foreign policy sphere like the Center for Strategic and International Studies and the Atlantic Council, regularly overlap their advocacy work with the interests of their well-heeled benefactors. But few have as such influence on the workings of the U.S. government, with at least 13 of the center's alumni ending up in the Biden administration to date. As the foreign policy equivalent of the Center for American Progress, this is, after all, why CNAS exists, to serve as the Democratic administration's foreign policy team. Washington, it seems, is finally back in the guiding hands of the experts who were always meant to be running the show.
Good morning.
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.